the message from Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and it sets the tone for our next conversation about a new exhibit at the City Museum of New York called New York New Music 1980 to 1986.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
That reality of New York City in the 80s, coupled with the energy and creativity of young musicians eager to cross-pollinate, plus the emergence of video, all created a potent music scene in this city. That moment is captured in the exhibit New York New Music 1980 to 86, featuring memorabilia, images, and of course music that brings the era to life. Music fans and music history fans will lap up the old articles from New York Rocker, the posters like the one from Glenn Branca, Flipper, and Sonic Youth for a show at Danceteria, the great map of clubs we all packed, Max's Kansas City, Tramps, the Cat Club, the Ritz, and so forth. And there were videos to watch of old school performances, including this 1980 clip from Kid Creole and the Coconuts.
I want you to listen to a story of woe and see if you can relate. Now, I got someone for whom I will do all that I possibly can. I take all me money, I spend it on you. Just name it, and I'm gonna claim it for you.
And then there are photos, young Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, and some classic images of the founding fathers and mothers of hip-hop. Joining us now is one of the photographers whose work is featured in the show, a return guest to all of it, Jeanette Beckman. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, how are you?
And doing well. And also joining us is Sean Cochran, the curator of prints and photos at the Museum of the City of New York, who is the master behind this show. Hi, Sean.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And full disclosure, I was lucky enough to spend a little bit of time as one of the consultants on this show. I just said Suzanne Vega a lot. So, Sean, what was the original idea for the show, and then how did it change?
The original idea for the show was to, we always wanted to kind of highlight the real energy that was happening in New York City at the time, and particularly the cross-pollination of music. We feel like in the early 80s in particular, a lot of different musical genres were meeting and influencing one another, be it on the stage or just socially in clubs. And we really wanted to get across the idea that people were mixing and giving each other ideas and that there was just so much vibrant life happening in the city, and at a time when New York wasn't always considered to be at its best.
So it's organized around 14 moments, because there's so much you could have covered. So what are a few examples of these moments that are highlighted in the exhibit?
To your point, we were originally thinking of just 14 bands or performers, and ultimately we decided, oh, that was just, you know, it left too much open, so we chose moments. And the idea of the moments was we could get in more groups, because, you know, multiple groups tend to be on the same bill. And so, for instance, and they take place in certain locations, so it can give people a sense of where people were experiencing music. And so you end up with something like DNA and a no wave band with Gray, which was Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat and Michael Holman's band in the early 1980s, performing at CBGB's, or Conk and Liquid, to kind of, I guess today they're kind of described as mutant disco bands that performed on a public bill at the old Tompkins Square Park band shell. Or Keith Haring's Party for Life with Larry Levan DJ. It took place at Paradise Garage, and Larry Levan was DJing, and they had, and John Sex and Madonna performed. So, you know, you get in all these different kinds of locations and clubs, and give an overarching impression of what the city was like at the time and what music was like at the time.
Jeanette, if there's jazz, punk represented, and a lot of hip-hop and rap, and you photographed many of these hip-hop artists before they were big, when they were just emerging, and you created some really iconic images, including that one of 17-year-old LL Cool J with a boombox on his shoulder. It's a great picture in the show. What was it about these artists that you were trying to capture with some of these earliest images?
Well, you know, I'm from London, and I only arrived in New York City in 1983, and everything was just happening all around me. So, you know, I was just trying to capture the energy of this new burgeoning culture, really, because I'd been documenting punk, and then I come here and hip-hop starting to happen. And that picture of LL Cool J, that was his very first press picture. So, you know, he was just young. I think he was 17 years old or maybe 16 when he came to my studio. You know, and I was just always trying to capture, you know, the essence of who these people were. And, you know, it was a very exciting time. And just to say, I was actually living on Avenue B and 8th Street by Tompkins Square. So every time I left my house, you know, there was graffiti everywhere, which made this sort of amazing wallpaper for my photos. Mm-hmm. Every time I needed to photograph somebody, there was always some great graffiti. And there was, you know, things happening at the band shell all the time. I mean, it was a very immersive time, I think.
Sean, the show features a section that describes what New York was like at this time, including a panel called Koch versus Youth Culture. What was going on financially and politically? I know, maybe laugh. What was going on financially and politically at the time that made this a fertile time for experimental and hungry artists? And what was Ed Koch's problem with the youth?
Well, you have to remember that, you know, in the 70s, the city nearly went bankrupt. There was a real serious fiscal crisis, and by 1980. Mayor Koch was doing some good things. He was, you know, implementing fiscal austerity and balancing the budget and getting the city back. But at the same time, you know, when you cut the budget, certain things get cut with it. Services get cut with it. And so, you know, there was a lot of lost opportunities for a lot of people. But at the same time, he was looking towards improving the city's reputation nationally and internationally, and he chose graffiti as one of the kind of problems to combat that giving the city a bad reputation. So he really went after them as kind of the graffiti risers as a real problem that was damaging the city's reputation. Now, on the other hand, this was pre-gentrification in certain areas, and it afforded artists the opportunity to come and live in the city for reasonable prices, or maybe if they were squatting, no prices at all. And, you know, it gave them a freedom to experiment, be it visual performing artists, you know, across the board. You know, you could come and try to make it as a musician or a visual artist and not have to worry all the time necessarily about how you were going to make your rent. So it was a city in transition, leaving the industrial past behind and becoming more focused on financial services. And mm-hmm. And as the years went on, you know, those opportunities for cheap living for artists began to wane.
Jeanette, you were just come to New York at the time. During this time, what was your experience of how the culture of New York affected the work that these artists were doing and making of your own art?
Well, it was a very, you know, it was a very experimental time, and it was, you know, hip hop. For me, as a visual person, and I like to wander the streets with my camera, you know, there'd be people breakdancing on the street, you know, graffiti was everywhere on the trains, you could go to Canal Street and buy a Rolex watch for $5. And all of this was very exciting for me and mm-hmm. great visuals. And, you know, photographing these hip-hop artists, I mean, my first album cover that I did here was for the Fearless Four, and that picture's in the show. And, you know, these guys are wearing these bright red leather outfits, and, you know, they've got their little chains and jerry curls, and it's just like a moment in time. You know, they've got a little, it was just very exciting for me visually, and the style was so different from the punk that I'd been used to. And it's interesting that you played that song, The Message, because in the beginning, I was living down in what is now Tribeca, and that song was constantly running through my head, because there really were, you know, junkies in the alley with baseball bats and rats and everything. But for some reason, I found it very exciting. And, you know, you just knew that something was happening, but we had no idea that these artists would become so famous, and that hip hop, you know, would become the biggest music genre ever. I mean, it's bigger than rock and roll now.
So. The name, the exhibit is called New York New Music 1980 to 1986. It's the Museum of City of New York. I'm speaking with Jeanette Beckman, a photographer whose work is in the show, and Sean Cochran, the curator. So, Sean, one thing I thought the exhibit did really well is it documents how the word spread about music and about bands and how people found out pre-Google. What are some of the important publications that we see in the exhibit, and how did people find out about shows and bands?
We have included a number of publications that were either, you know, local weekly magazines like the Village Voice, and we include several spreads of just the music listings, and to see those is really remarkable, and you can see how every different type of music was being played, sometimes on the same stage within a week. And, you know, there was the New York Rocker, there was the East Village Eye, the Village Voice I mentioned, and then, of course, there were national magazines like Rolling Stone, and Cream was around then. But then also, you know, it's important to note the importance of radio at the time with places like WBLS, and, you know, the radio was still really important in finding out a lot about music. And then another thing that's really kind of important to the exhibition visually, but really gets a point across on how people found out about shows, are handbills and flyers. They would be, you know, future shows would have, you know, if you went to a show, you know, there would be people handing out flyers for, you know, upcoming shows, or they would be wheat pasted around the city. So there's, you know, all these ways of kind of finding out about shows, and, you know, also word of mouth. You know, you just walk around the city and bump into people and say, oh, I have a show happening in a week or so. So, you know, it was all pre-internet kind of word of mouth in the print, on the radio kind of situation. And then eventually video.
This brings me to the Blondie's Rapture from 81, sort of gets all the themes together. The video features Basquiat and Fab Five Freddy. How do you think this really shows what was happening at that time, Blondie's Rapture?
You really have this kind of cross-pollination of genre happening. And, you know, the story is that, you know, Fab Five Freddy became a real connector, and mm-hmm. he was bringing people together of all different genre. And, you know, Freddy hung out in the Mud Club, and he knew, you know, he knew Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, and yeah. at the same time he was uptown, and he knew Flash.